Welcome to Entitled Town. I'm Dave Brown. With me is my co-host, Iron Mike Irons, a.k.a. Ironhead 334, a.k.a. Displaced Bostonian. We are the undrafted free agents of podcasting. Anyone could have had us, but you're stuck with us. So today's show, I know we're very eager to get into a topic here.
We're eager.
We're eager, but first let me say, hi, Mike, and welcome to the first episode of Entitled Town.
Counselor, how are you, my friend?
Doing well. I'm a journalist and a lawyer. I cover the New England Patriots. Mike is the angriest man on Twitter, and boy, do we have a reason to be angry today. Why don't you go ahead and tell us what it is we're angry about?
Well, the morons associated with the WEEI morning show have managed to step into it again. Ken Laird, you are our first target. Congratulations. Have a cookie.
Well, I think let's give people a little bit of background here. So Tom Brady signed a contract extension on Sunday, and for the most part, the Boston media kind of kept its collective self together for about 24 hours. There were some interesting comments. There were some interesting perspectives on this thing. But then Ken Laird, who, as you mentioned, produces the Greg Hill Show on WEEI, he went on the 2-6 show in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh wanted to get to, I guess, the Pony and Mueller, or Pony and Mueller, perhaps, that show wanted to...
Between that show and the Greg Hill Morning Show, it's like two losing scratch tickets. Nice job, Laird.
Well, that show wanted to talk about how it is that Tom Brady is always signing these below-market contracts, which gives the Patriots, I guess some people would say, an edge because it frees up money to spend on other free agents. And how is it that they always get Tom Brady to do this? And so they start off in an interesting place. You want me to just go ahead and play Laird's answer?
Oh, please do.
Okay.
Yeah, but what does Belichick have to do with it, Ken? I mean, can't Brady go to Jonathan Kraft or Robert Kraft and say, I want $40 million a year, and they'll just rubber stamp it?
All right, I'm going to pause here. So absolutely. First of all,
let's there's a lot of stupid packed into about 9 seconds there.
Well, I think it's important to walk through this because Ken Laird is not on the Patriots beat. His morning
Morrissey, show, he's also not a Juilliard level intellect.
Okay. And I know you're on the board of admissions at Juilliard, so you are fit to judge that. But he's not on the Patriots beat. He's in a Patriots adjacent area in his job because he's on a sports radio station.
He's not even Patriots adjacent. He's Greg Hill's fluffer.
Well, they do have Brady on the show, and he was he producing? No, he wasn't producing before, right?
He was involved with the Mutt and Callahan disaster, and he's, you know,
okay.
He should know better because he was on the program when Brady came on the morning show after Remus stepped in it.
Okay.
In a night. So he should know better.
And that was the pissant.
The annoying little pissant talking about Brady's, you know, toddler daughter.
Okay, here's his first mistake. They ask him, couldn't Brady just go and get a rubber stamp from Jonathan Kraft or Robert Kraft on this $40 million contract? First of all, nobody is giving Tom Brady $40 million. No team in the NFL is going to do that. For a couple of reasons. One, I don't think anybody's going to get $40 million in 2019, given where the cap is, any quarterback. I think it would be a few years before even a guy like Mahomes, who's young and on the rise, can sign that kind of deal because the cap just isn't it's like 20%, I think it would be more than 20% of the cap space right now. So that's silly. And then – they're acting as if Belichick doesn't have authority over the cap. And that's where Ken Laird is saying, no, Belichick makes this decision. He's been
What's given the governing authority. Principle that they've operated by since Belichick's been there? They want depth. They want, you know, quality players throughout the roster. You don't do that by paying one player, as great as he is, $40 million a year.
Right.
And by the way,
but Laird has to tell them.
The other teams are going to be pissed off at you.
Right. Well, Laird has to tell them that No, that's not how things work here. Is that they put Belichick in charge of football operations because he makes these decisions and he makes them well, and he makes a tough call to say that a guy like Brady isn't worth $40 million. Never mind the fact that that $40 million figure is outrageous. Also, never mind the fact that there's been so much criticism today about how much Brady is making. He'll be the sixth highest paid quarterback in the NFL. And at a time when everybody's telling us, the same people who are complaining about his contract also tell us that his skills are declining and he's no longer a top five quarterback.
He's also a system money launderer.
So, right. Well, let's get into that. Let's get into the rest of what Ken Laird told Pony and I'm gonna go with Mueller. Pony and
not,
Mueller.
Not Bill Miller.
Not Bill. Listen, it's a 2-6 show. That's your big clue here.
That's not
either they have an agreement in place that Brady's going to have part of the ownership of the team when he's done, or
okay. First
stop,
of all,
stop. There we go.
Stop. What is he talking about? Is he saying that they might have an agreement in place? I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he's guessing. That is best case scenario. That is a terribly irresponsible.
Well, hold on, Dave. Yeah. He said, and I quote, "They have an agreement in place that right. Brady's going to have part ownership of the team when he's done." End quote.
Right, and I bet you a lot of people heard it that way. So now I know, like a year from now, when or the next time the Patriots, maybe even opening day weekend, when I have all these Steelers fans in my mentions on Twitter telling me about the shady deals going on between Brady and Kraft, I'll at least now know who the source was. And it will have been Ken Laird, who, you know, in this era of where people are having a tough time discerning what's right and what's wrong in the news, he says something that is entirely unattributed. There's never been a report that there's a secret ownership deal looming in the future. If Ken Laird has some source somehow.
And that maybe John Tomasi maybe videotaped this conversation. So, I mean, come on.
Maybe. He's obligated to say it if he has a source. Or even just to say, I have a source. He doesn't have to tell us who it is. But to sort of put – we just saw this a couple months ago with the Nick Caserio story and Ben Folan, where a lot of people in the readers and the audience didn't understand whether Ben was sharing an opinion about Caserio wanting out or if he was reporting sourced news about Caserio wanting out.
But to be fair, Mittens didn't know either.
I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know, and I agree with you. I don't know if Ben knew whether that was merely an opinion or something sourced. And that's where we get into this shaky ground of, you know, when you just make a statement like that, people are going to walk away with the wrong impression. Now,
especially when people in Pittsburgh that want to believe it.
Of course.
It's a willing audience.
Of course. You know,
and it didn't happen in a darkened bathroom with the Steelers quarterback, so they'll want to believe it.
Well, it becomes this echo chamber of conspiracy theories, and let's see where it goes beyond the secret ownership deal back to Ken Laird on 2-6 in Pittsburgh.
Or he's already getting a handshake. I mean, for years people have speculated that there's got to be some kind of other money funneling to Brady.
But, well, how about the TB12 thing, Ken? How about right. that?
Okay, how about the TB12 thing?
Well, he starts to say there's a handshake agreement, and he stops himself because then he realizes, like, holy shit, I may have just stepped in it.
Maybe. The TB12 thing. So the league has investigated the TB12 arrangement, and honestly, good for the league for looking into it. It was kind of a new thing where you have a player who's operating a business that the team occasionally uses. And when you have a situation like that, that in theory, you know,
unless Jimmy Garoppolo's on the team, then the media reports that Jimmy Garoppolo's not allowed in there.
And Jimmy can't find his keys.
Jimmy's looking in from the outside like he's you know, and say anything, holding the radio outside of Guerrero's window.
Right. So the thing is with TB12, okay, so they looked into it, they said nothing was wrong going on, and good for them for looking into it. But
well, the NFL, the 345 Park Avenue has a history of letting the Patriots off lightly, so let's just discount that.
Well, here's the other thing, is that if anybody's been paying attention the last couple of years, from what we've heard and what we've been told.
Well, they haven't at WEI, but go ahead.
Well, from what we've been told by people who reported on serious tensions that were going to tear the Patriots apart, this manifested during the 2017 season, the Patriots are actually steering players away from Alex Guerrero and TB12. So if the theory is that they're funneling more work through TB12, that theory is sort of offset by this other these other reports that said the Patriots kind of don't want players using those services.
You know, I got to tell you, it's almost as if the media has no fucking idea what's going on in the Patriots front office or with the TB12 place.
Well, it's tough. And this is where people have to be paying attention, because now you have contradictory narratives where...
That's a specialty of the Boston sports media, contradicting narratives.
Well, yeah. And so this narrative contradicts another one, and it's possible that neither is true. So anyway, I think I don't know Ken Leard. I don't listen to WEEI much, but this was just a gross irresponsibility. There's 18 seconds left in this clip, but I think we about covered it.
Well, gross irresponsibility with EEI when it comes to anything to do with Brady is par for the course. So go ahead, play it.
Well, they interview him every week. He does a good job. He shows up for them. Some would say they could ask him tougher questions, but I don't know how tough of an interview Tom Brady is showing up for.
And by the way, they pay Brady multiples upon multiples more than Ken Laird gets to throw slander his way.
Right. So what I'll say, so you have the transcript there in front of you. Did we cover it all, or should I play the last 18 seconds?
Play the last 18 seconds.
Okay.
Right. He's got a TB12 center right in Gillette Stadium in the complex there. So it's obviously a good situation. I think that's essentially what it comes back to. He's not hurting for money. He's got Giselle. Money matters to him, but not to the point where he wants to go and recreate something elsewhere after 20 years and the legacy he's put together.
Right. And so then
that's kind of, he kind of backpedals at the end.
Yeah. Then we just cram in all of the counterpoint reasons, like Giselle's financial success and the fact that Brady, is he going to go do a Brett Favre kind of thing and start over somewhere else? I don't know.
Oh, I was a little bit worried you're going to go to a camera picture there. But
no, I don't think. I don't. I think Tom Brady knows all about the when it comes to privacy and cell phones. I think Brady is well aware of how that can end up poorly. So that's where the less juicy Occam's razor, most likely to be true type answers get the short shrift at the end there. So here's the thing. Tom Brady, if you want to talk about his past contracts and him giving the Patriots a break, I think you're in a better position than you are now, because they're entering uncharted territory with a guy who's 42 years old. They handle these details and in our interview with Matt Chatham, he'll talk about how the Patriots go through your value and assign a number based on the services and what you're supposed to get. And how are they supposed to chart a guy who just turned 42?
Well, there's no template for this. But if you turn the clock back, 5-10 years, it's a matter of record. And again, these fucking mediates aren't paying attention. Kraft had a conversation with Brady in the earlier this decade. And again, it's on the record. It's not that hard to find. Where he said, if you want to be paid top of the market money, it's probably not going to work. And the last 20 years, give or take, has proven that the formula of having depth is successful. I've made the point on Twitter is that the least successful season the Patriots have had in the last 8 years is akin to the most successful season the Jets have had in the last 50. It works. And he's bought in. Everything he says publicly has backed this. Now, there's been some, some stuff that's written and said in the radio that, you know, Brady, you know, Tom Senior is always lurking in the shadows as this, you know, source emeritus. But, you know, the results work and the rest of this shit is just drama. You know, sometimes it's benign, like the things that happened last week, the Parcells and the Patriots Hall of Fame stuff. And then it rises to this level of journalistic and broadcasting malfeasance that Laird had.
Right, right. This is irresponsible. And I don't think there's any question about that. And the thing is, he's not a person who covers the team. He's an observer like others. And this is where
he turns dials in a studio in Brighton.
And this is where you have.
He's a dumber version of Jimmy Stewart.
The radio show not getting the best a person with an inside perspective on the Patriots, and then the person they bring in not minding his responsibility to share information in a way that you know is truthful and isn't you know giving oxygen to these crazy conspiracy theories. So
there's not a lot of intellectual honesty in this equation.
Fair. Okay. What do you say we go to our interview now with Matt Chatham and let the people hear from someone who's smarter than both of us?
Well, I probably went a little bit too far, fanboy. Matt Chatham is smart. He has perspective and, you know, certainly knows a lot more about football than you and I.
Yep, three-time Super Bowl champion and a champion of journalism with The Athletic, with NESN, with ESPN. I think that's all of them, but there could be more. Anyway, we're gonna let you have let you hear this interview with Matt Chatham. Hope you enjoy it.
I'm gonna do a little corny opening here.
There you go.
As I said in our DM, it's my hope that I'll introduce you in a way that's unique.
Okay.
All right, so here we go. Our guest on the Country 93.7 guest line can be seen on NESN breaking down the Patriots. He's a contributor to The Athletic Boston. He calls college football for ESPN. He's also on Patriots This Week for Kraft Sports, but you probably know him best as former New York Jet Matt Chatham. Matt, welcome to Entitled Town. How you doing, man?
It's great to be on, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. So I think one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is because you're complicit in starting all of this
right.
In the sense that before people like you showed up, Boston didn't really have many expectations as far as championship goes. I mean, the ambition was there, but the idea that this could happen every year or there could be two parades a year and that kind of stuff wasn't really going on before you showed up. So why did you torture these nice people by winning all these titles?
I'll tell you what, Dave, I would probably be thrown in that pile of people with low expectations when I first got here myself. I mean, I was an undrafted free agent from University of South Dakota, Division II school at the time. They're FCS now. They've moved up a bit in the world. But at my time, Joe Andruzzi, Southern Connecticut guy, those same type size schools, D2 schools, long shots to make it in the NFL. And I had started in St. Louis, and I was an undrafted free agent there in 99, waited on pins and needles like a lot of small school guys do. You know, you're an All-American type at that level, but how does that translate? Are they going to actually draft me? You never know. You get a phone call in the fifth round, you sit and wait, sixth round, you wait. And then at the end, I got an offer from the Colts, Browns, and Rams, and I chose the Rams, and it was because back then, a guy who actually I have a lot of respect for, which clearly isn't related to this particular act, but at the time, Leonard Little had that drunk driving accident, and, you know, Fellowship Christian Athletes guy, really solid dude. They took him out for his 21st birthday, his rookie year, and he got in a drunk driving accident, a couple drinks in for someone who just wasn't used to doing that, and drove home when he shouldn't. Someone died, and at that time, you know, he was facing a suspension, so I've got the agent who's looking at rosters and trying to figure out a place to go, and presuming the outside linebacker spot there might have a guy down. We chose that spot, but then back then, Tagliabue reinserted him without much of a suspension, sort of a time served kind of situation. So then I ended up getting cut from that team and then come here to New England. But my long winding story to get to this is, you know, when I got cut from Earth City, there in St. Louis is, you know, they'd won in 99 and it was kind of a winning environment sort of place. And I'm coming to New England. Belichick's brand new. It's his. I just missed his first training camp. I played on week one of his first season, but when I got dropped from that place and came to this place, I kind of had similar thoughts. Like, I had to quick look into, I don't know, whatever it been, not internet then, but somehow look at the history. And
going from the greatest show on turf to a rebuilding organization.
That's right. And it was striking, I think, just to the quality of the facilities, too. That's, I should hedge this a little bit because it was still a cool game day environment for me. I know it's much more of a college atmosphere. I know the fan experience wasn't great sitting up on those concrete seats and all that stuff. But it still had like a nice sort of pseudo Big Ten kind of feel for me. And I didn't get to play in those kinds of stadiums. So I did appreciate game day. It was just the, you know, like, you know, random folding chairs and partitions between the meeting rooms and a grungy small weight room, the locker room. There was in the corner with the Patriots, it's Slade. Chris Slade was 53, Willie's 55. 6 and 7 are retired. That's Steve Nelson and Tip, so Andre Tippett. So I'm 58, so I'm always next to Willie. And right there in that corner, Willie was the corner spot. It's kind of the primo spot. He's kind of the big dog on the team. And right in that corner, though, there's a breakthrough in the side, and there's a shitter behind it. So behind that wall. So if you sit in that corner, there's a guy you can hear shit on the other side of the wall. So, you know, it's not this is not opulent. This is not like a super nice place, but you still look around, and it's like, yeah, Drew Bledsoe, and, you know, and Chris Slade, and Willie, and Ty Law, and names, you know, and Terry Glenn and stuff. So it was a very rough year. I would just simply say that 2000 was a year that I think kind of proud to have been a part of, because with all the success that came later, I think people sometimes forget about that 2000 year, man. We weren't very good, but it was more the survivors that came out of that group that became part of Bill's core going forward that, you know, kind of glad you went through that process too, because I think it helped bring about some of the other stuff.
Did your proximity to the shitter help prepare you for the experience with the Jets?
That's a good. Well, you know what? They were at Hofstra the 3 years I was there, or the two, and then the third years when they transitioned over the other place. And so, you know, Hofstra was slightly better, but it did kind of have an air of, you know, those years where I was at the nicer place here at Gillette. Then you went back, and you went back onto a college campus, and, you know, it was not as dilapidated, I guess, but it wasn't certainly nearly as nice. But, oh, man, that's a nice place that they have now there, but years ago. But no, the weirdest thing with the Jets was just wearing the green. You felt like a pickle, like you're just so used to you've been used to wearing the red and blue sweats or gray sweats with red, white, and blue stuff your whole time, and you kind of becomes a part of your identity for the 6 years I was there. And then you show up, and it's like these pickle green sweats every day, and it just took you probably that first full season so you felt normal wearing them.
Well, thank God you didn't play for Rex.
Well, I played for Rob, and Rob's like one of my favorite guys ever. I don't know Rex well other than some charity golf tournament stuff. He's a good time, but no, I miss that era. It was just the Manguini days. That was those three, what is it, 6, 7, and the tail end of 8 there.
Well, you made the point earlier about you didn't really believe when you came onto the Patriots in 2000. So at what point did you believe in the 2001 season?
We had a really, really good defense, and this is probably, again, one of the things that gets lost in, I think, the 0-1 run that I barked about it a little bit online or in columns that I've written for The Athletic or any of the outlets. Maybe it was Fox. Maybe it was the years of the Football by Football. But it's a topic I try to bring up and hammer as much as I possibly can because, man, there was so much talent in that defensive meeting, in that defensive room, period. Great coaching staff. You look at, you know, from Romeo Crennel to Rob Ryan to Mangini himself to, you know, up and down sort of the list of people that were in that room. Pepper Johnson was an excellent position coach. We had a lot of coaching talent, and we had a ton of playing talent defensively. So I think you go back and you replay the 0-1 game now, and you know the names, you know who's involved in that game, and I look at it and go, shoot, they're lucky they scored the points they scored. I mean, it's Willie, it's Ty. Bobby Hamilton was a monster, not a big name to a lot of people. Man, he's a really good player. You were just getting introduced to Richard Seymour, who became one of the best at his position throughout the time he played in the league. And Ty Law's a Hall of Famer, and Otis Smith was playing excellent at that time. Yeah, Lawyer Malloy and Tabucky. I just played golf with Tabucky a couple days ago. I mean, that guy still looks like a linebacker now. I think in today's game, he's probably a box safety. I mean, he's just a specimen. And Roman Pfeiffer comes on as the extra linebacker. Brew's obviously an exceptional leader, amazing player. Ted Johnson's a rotating guy at the time. You got a player of that quality that's one of your extra dudes. Brian Cox comes on the team. I mean, that was an absolutely loaded team. Brandon Mitchell, who was the other defense, and then a lot of people sometimes forget about. But, man, that team was exceptional. It was really fun to have been a part of that group.
you've talked about how Bill, how Belichick is somebody you respect more than even some of your family members. At least somebody quoted you as saying that. What is it? Where does that respect come from? Because I feel like what we see in press conferences and what people see on Sunday is almost a two-dimensional picture of Bill Belichick. Yeah. What is the third dimension there that leads you to feel that way?
So I feel like I'm always a little bit limited by the mediums, but you know, I do TV, so we're talking short segments. I mean, I'm on a lot, but it's, you know, we're on for 3 or 4 minutes at a time. So you don't really get into the depth of the game. And that's just kind of the nature of most of TV in this kind of market, the right. kind of shows we're on. On my own podcast, I can talk a little bit more, but it's not a visual medium, so you're not really out and explaining and showing. So, you know, it's the real depth of sort of expertise that Bill has. It's not something that you can really get into a lot. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about him is I was kind of a dork. I was kind of a nerd about the X's and O's stuff. Although now it's, you know, 5% of what we ever actually talk about when I'm on the air. That's the part that I feel like I have is, you know, I could walk into most rooms with, I don't care who's working in media or what function, and I can hold my own in that realm. I mean, it's a part that I really grasp well. And I know that in saying that about myself, which sounds a little boastful, Bill makes me like a simpleton, you know? So it's when you're around someone, when you know it really well, and you know you only know it a fraction of what that guy does, a small fraction, then you sort of appreciate, whoa, you know, like the Keanu Reeves kind of voice, like, whoa, this guy is like amazing. And I think it's to the extent that, you know, and you'll occasionally hear a snarky media member say, yeah, you know, this isn't brain surgery, or this isn't, you know, it's really just football. It's not that complicated. No, it is. It is. If you understand the depth of technique, that each guy's got a dozen things on his plate. Each guy has to learn a very meticulous kind of job function that isn't as easy as what you just see by studying an info Game Pass subscription or whatever. If you understand how difficult each of the 11 component parts are, and then you start mixing into it different fronts and different adjustments and different things and tags on calls, and then all the different assignments they have within the call, and then knowing that guy knows all 11 plus 100 different packages and groupings that he has, and he knows it over time of 30, 40 years, and he doesn't just know it, you know, because there's a lot of coaches that are long tenure. He knows it at a level better than everyone else. I mean, you realize that stuff, then it's just really easy to appreciate. I think the last little thing for me with Bill is he was hard as hell on me. And I think I've told this before on my own podcast and, you know, random media things over the years. But one of the things he did to me that I can be open about this now. I hated him a little bit for it at the time, and I had no right to. But we traveled to Denver. Mile High Stadium was the last time I played there, the one time I played there. But I recall this game. We got beat out there, and the story sort of briefly goes, we get back in the locker room. It was a tough loss. It happened to be one of those games where a lot of the front office traveled. So there were families. There was, you know, scouting staff, you know, C-class stuff. Brady? Everyone's up front.
Was that the game Brady threw 4 picks in 0-1?
Oh, might be. I want to say, I think, is it the 0-1 game? I'm not even sure. I was thinking Drew was still the quarterback then, but I don't recall specifics other than my own terrible performance. So basically we get back in the locker room, and this is Bill's speech, and he has a knack for being real brief and real to the point. And he was like, the defense sucked, the offense sucked, and Matt fucking Chatham, let's get on this plane and get out of here. And I was like, holy shit, I just got cut, you know? So I'm a super young player at the time, you know, I'm playing on game days, I'm playing some linebacker and special teams, but, you know, I'm feeling like number 45 of the 45-man roster. So, and then that speech happened, and Denver's relatively close to my people in South Dakota and Iowa, so that was a game that I traveled out and had a bunch of tickets, so... I had gotten a personal foul in the game. Diaz Infante's a last name of the long snapper. He'd been staring up at a fair catch, and I wiped him out. And then I got a holding call a little bit later on a punt return, so I had back-to-back bad calls, back penalties. And I just remember the story ends this way. I didn't know that on staff meetings on Monday when they had flown back that Bill had actually advocated in that meeting to cut me. And Rob Ryan – And Brad Seeley was our special team coach for all those years, and Rob was my position coach, had came back and said later that they went hard advocating for me and said, hey, there's still something there. There's a lot there. He's kind of a knucklehead right now. He'll learn your way. We'll get on him. And they leaned on me, and it was a rough couple weeks. He just felt like, I can't be myself. I can't do what I want to do. I can't be aggressive and hit and just be a little bit of a fighter guy. But that pressure, that sort of, diamond kind of situation where you were just, I felt like the world on my shoulders and felt like I was losing my job every minute of the day. I kind of felt like I came out the other side better for that, and heard that story and joked about that story later with other coaches and even Bill a little bit. And I kind of appreciated more for it. It's like, you know what? I hated you at the time, but you were right. I was wrong. And I think going through it helped me.
What's the biggest lesson you took away from playing under Belichick for the time you did?
Probably to look at things and see what other people aren't seeing. I mean, I think anyone, and again, I don't mean to say this derogatorily, because let's put it this way. If I'd never played in the NFL, I would know no more than anyone else if I were to flip on Game Rewind. You know, if I get a subscription and just kind of see, and I could trace the lines of where people run, and I could draw circles around them and tell you the ball went here and this went there, and it looked like there were two people in the deep part of the field, and hey, it looks like, man, those, I mean, you can learn the language and talk about things like that. But that's not really what's going on. That's like the sort of Cliff Notes version of what's out there. The real stuff is in there, and kind of trying to find what kicked the play off, why it progressed as it did, what were sort of the little quirks within the play that made it happen, or some things that were sort of near misses. Just what I always really appreciate about Bill is you walk in a room, there's 50 guys waiting to hear what he has to say. On every play, there's a couple guys that think, I kind of fucked up a little bit on this one, or, you know, maybe I didn't quite do it right, or you're anticipating some praise on something you think he did well. And Bill just always had a knack for cutting through the bullshit and maybe actually finding something that, even though this play worked, here I found X, Y, and Z, and you realize how close this was to being really bad, or how close this was to being something that, you know, was different, that we need to keep an eye on. So he just really has a knack for seeing what's not obvious. So it kind of teaches you to try to look that way yourself.
So one of the things that struck me when I started covering this team in 2006 was how disgruntled the media was. With Bill, with sort of the way he answered questions, and with that carrying over to the players, with sort of a lot of these answers about, we're on to next week. All of the focus being on just this week's game and these sort of, very non-answer type answers. And what struck me was I thought maybe there was some value in that to what it was that the team was trying to do and keeping everybody focused on the task at hand. Is there any truth to that? I mean, am I correct somewhat in that read that there is some value in the way that this team organizationally approaches the media?
Yeah, no, I absolutely believe it, and I think I had some negative experiences in New York, and granted, Eric was trying to do the same thing Bill did, like I said, again, just wearing green while doing it, but they attempted some of those things, and you would see when people would slip up. I slip up myself. I think you sometimes get a little too comfortable with yourself when you get away from that New England environment, and it was actually a game, it was a playoff game, actually, against the Patriots, when we had beat the Jets, we had beat the Patriots in New England that last game on grass before they flipped it over to turf, and we won that
old
game.
Old habits die hard, Matt. Old habits die hard.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And we had to make that trip back up there for the first round of the playoffs. And unfortunately for me, I was a captain on that team, and that's not the unfortunate part. That was good. But the unfortunate part was my father-in-law actually passed that game week. So we're in the playoffs. I'm a captain. There's a lot of responsibilities as far as media availabilities for captains going out through the course of the week. And my father-in-law had actually been struck by a train. He worked for the railroad at the time, has his whole life, and super emotional thing for our family. I'm the guy with Kimo Van Olhoffen, some other guys were brought into that locker room by Eric to kind of try to do a sort of Steeler Patriot tough, smarter environment.
That was a good football team. That was a really good football team.
Yeah. It was, and it was a fun one to be a part of, outside of the part that it was in New England. But in saying that, though, I had this sort of little mini family personal tragedy going on, and I came back, and because I'd missed, I did miss Wednesday and Thursday's practice on a playoff week, which is just unfathomable, and your head's somewhere else. And I came back and I did my Friday media availability. And when you're the only one who hasn't spoken yet, you get the 20 cameras from the New York media looking for some soundbite to say something crazy. And I did. And it out of character. You know, they hit me with something about how, you know New England, you're from there and all this stuff and been a part of all that stuff there. How did you, what is it? What does this mean if those guys aren't able to win this game and you guys go up there and beat them? And I think in my head I was phrasing it as if I was meant it as a compliment, but it didn't come out as a compliment. Mm-hmm. I said essentially it means so much up to them up there. They care so much. They put so much into it. Boy, are they going to be miserable when they don't win this game. I don't know if I said win or if, but something to that effect. And I meant it to be more emphasized the part about, wow, how much effort they put into it, how smart they are, how much goes into it to get there, that will just make the after effect that more exponentially painful. But it certainly isn't a compliment. It did not come out like it should have come out. So anyway, we get to the game, and in pregame, we're out there running around, and like I said, I mean, I have a playlist that I've been playing through the funeral, through the flight back, that my head's somewhere else, and I'm in pregame warmups. One of my buddies on the Patriots comes over and goes, dude, you made the board. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you know, there's a quote board, the Saturday night thing at the hotel. He's like, they're fucking all over you. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what? What'd I say? I'm like, what? I didn't say anything. What are you talking about? You know, so like my head is like completely gone. I mean, I had enough other distractions to begin with. And then I'm,
right,
you know, like, what the hell did I? And I'm not joking. And I used to do this to other guys myself, but we'd come up to the line and guys just say, Chatham, and then they'd repeat the quote back to you, and like everyone, and it's like, son of a bitch, and like then you're not focusing, right? And then you blow a call or something, or you miss a play, you're just not quite sharp. But it contributed, let's put it that way. And I think it kind of changed my frame of mind. It's like, you know what, this stuff can be used against you. I use it against guys all the time. If you could pull a quote or find something from the week and you talk shit throughout the time, especially you get them down on driver two, and you know, there's a psychological element to the game. So I think his philosophy is, why invent a distraction? Why create one? There's enough other shit going on. Don't put anything else out there.
What you're saying is that there is some awareness of what's said in the media. I'm going to guess by the players and also by the media itself, right? That there's some awareness of what the criticisms are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, both sides. Yeah. I mean, with the players, the kinds of stuff that are more aggravating is indications of scheme potential, right? You walk into the Monday session, you've rewatched the last week's game film, some of the staff's been up all Sunday night, and they're working all day Monday to get their position group graded, but then also try to put together sort of the front end of a game plan for Wednesday. You show up for that Wednesday install meeting early morning, you've gotten your lift, you're ready to roll, and you get a packet that's, you know, got three or four or five different new calls defensively that kind of have a quirk for this new opponent. So you're going to be working on a few things that may be a little different than what you did on film the last week or even month or so or whatever it is. You go through the lifting session, you go through the lunch session, then it's open locker room, and you get a reporter to come up to you and you say, what do you see with the fucking Chiefs or Colts or whoever it is this week? And you say, oh man, we're going to come after him this week, man. And I'm excited. You know, something to an indication of pressure, which it's real benign. It's not like you're saying the call. But if you're a coordinator and, you know, this team's like, you know, the Patriots, they blitz on an 8 to 12 to 15% clip depending on the opponent. And we've got two guys blurting out stuff about more pressure. Well, shit, let's go spend an extra period or two on pressure packages. Let's go look back a month and see what they might draw up. Or, hey, let's look at the stuff that people have been doing to us factored into how it would be sort of impounded against these guys and how they might pull it off. And fuck it, let's throw in a couple extra periods. So then they go work on it more, and then you do come into the game and you try to blitz at a 35% clip or something that's out of character, and holy shit, they were actually prepared for it just because of some stupid blurted out comment. And it sounds like it wouldn't be that way, but when you remember, we all have a finite amount of time. You know, the practice periods are real scripted. So if they're going to change because they think there's some issue with, say, an injury, right? Like, say you got a guard down that's really a big part of their running game, and you're going to say, oh, fuck, their blocking tight end's hurt also, and you know, whatever. There's a couple things that might affect their ability to run the football. Well, then you work on other periods. You don't overscript certain stuff. So if you get a little clue like that, or something stupid, or somebody blurting out, man, I'm taking player X all day long. You know, give some indication that shit. You really think they'll mark him all game? Well, then that'll affect how we approach it. Just There's no reason to throw breadcrumbs out there. That's the point. Sometimes are real, right. Sometimes are not.
We saw that a lot in the playoffs this year with Tyreek Hill. Who's going to cover Tyreek Hill? And everybody buttoned up. Every defensive back you talk to, just how are you going to cover him? And they came out and they had a unique way to deal with him, and nobody heard about it all week.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine in that scenario if Jonathan Jones is blurting out, I'm fucking taking him, you know? Like, I mean, but wouldn't that send everyone back to go studying? I mean, you have the benefit of him not studying you all week and while you're working on him. Every game I went into, I had a few different keys on a tight end or a tackle that I might be over, and I knew my guy forward and back that I was going to face on kick, punt return. I mean, I knew everything. Last thing I would do was be bragging about how I'm going to take him down. I'd rather use sort of the element of surprise when we get out there. So there's no reason to talk.
And the time and the preparation are invaluable, because if you're preparing for the wrong thing,
exactly,
you're going to have a big problem.
Exactly. Well, imagine like a pass rusher who's known to be working both sides, right? So say like a guy like Willie, super versatile. I mean, he could play left, he could play right. The years where Rosie was there, Rosie played more right side, Willie'd mostly be left. Rabes can do just everything. You know, he could be left, right, he could be all over the place. But imagine Willie coming out and, you know, spending too much time talking about the left tackle when they've been seeing him on the right guy. You know what I mean? It gives you a clue, and it might send a guy in to do a couple more hours of film sessions, or it might cause a head coach to re-script practice stuff and stick the Willie body type guy over his tackle for 30 reps in practice, just to allow him to work on it. So there's no reason to give those keys. There's no reason.
So these truncated answers aren't necessarily about being standoffish with the media or not feeding a story. It's about keeping everything to plan and not giving things away when you don't have to.
Everything to the vest.
All right, Matt, you mentioned aggression on defense earlier, and I want to go in the way back machine to the Sunday night game against the Rams at the old Foxborough Stadium back in 01.
Yeah.
You guys blitzed the ever-living shit out of Kurt Warner that night. You got some turnovers. I remember Terrell Buckley took one back. Teddy Bruschi got a turnover. How surprised were you that you totally changed everything up and you sent such limited pressure in the Super Bowl? You guys were on the field a long time on defense. The game plan on offense, you know, really didn't work, if we're being honest. You know, how did that go? How was the change? And, you know, how confident are you guys going into 36?
So I'll put it this way, and I think it's one of the things that really sticks with me when I'm doing breakdowns and I'm trying to sort of delve into those dangerous waters of what's the key to the game, or little things like that. When I'm doing video breakdowns, I find people making this error in media perpetually, right? The idea that they've got some secret coverage that's the key to the game, or some secret matchup that's the key to the game. And that's really not how Coach Belichick goes about it. It's not, hey, this team typically does X. This week, we're going to play way more this coverage. And then, you know, you'll see the article or whatever that puts this guy on that guy, this guy on that guy, the cat defense. You take this cat, you take that cat, that whole thing. That's not how it works. That's a very kind of high school view of it. And it's not unreasonable if that's your only sort of experience. But keys to games and elements that he's looking to pull out isn't walking in on that Wednesday morning meeting and saying, we're playing St. Louis. The key to beating St. Louis is much more cover five than two. We're going to leverage it this way. We'll rush only in this version. We're going to play this cut. We're going to play cover four this way this particular week, and less of these four-man fronts and more of an odd front with the flow. Point is that he's not going to say X's and O's shit. That the key to the game isn't some X's and O's quibble. The key to the game is the element that he'll pull. And that's a great example where it's, okay, here's what they do best. They free release like motherfucker. They're scary as hell if you let them run. If Ricky Prohl gets moving, doesn't get jammed, he jukes everyone. If you get Marshall Faulk free releasing, holy hell, we're screwed. If Isaac Bruce is roaring off the line, Torrey, I mean, it's just, they're too good. It's unfair. So the key to the game isn't more of this coverage or less of this coverage or more of this blitzing even or less of this blitzing. It's the element that precedes it, and it's the physical nature, not allowing them into making sure that the read, when Kurt completes him, and he will because he's good, comes on his third, comes on his fourth. We got to batter him at the line. The releases can't be free. We got to flatten routes. We got to make sure he goes into the progression and then hope that the more minimal pressures, you mentioned Mike, you know, with the three or four man rush, makes him uncomfortable. And then we'll pick and choose our spots. We'll bring an extra guy occasionally. Rabes gets a great one off the edge, you know, strip sack, Willie, all that kind of stuff. Those things are going to happen. But the key to it wasn't a coverage. But I think a lot of the media segments will do that, you know, say, hey, the Patriots have been using X percentage of this. this week I've got the magic matchup. I'm going to put this person on Tyreek, like you said, and this person's going to cover Kelsey. That's really not the thought process. That's sort of, you know,
well,
the peripheral
it's simplistic. It's simplistic. Yeah. Did you guys think you could, you know, just beat the hell out of them?
Yeah, well, I think what it is it, you can just say be physical, that's one thing, but it's also where do you want to funnel them? Where do you want to send the body? So in every defense, you've got a free player generally. I mean, we play a thing like man-to-man. When you've got four linebackers on the ball in the core, when we're 3-4 defense, you're typically dealing with three eligibles. You're typically dealing with a tight end and two backs, or two tight ends, one back, or a tight end, one back, and an F, something like that. There's three and there's four of us, right? So there's a free body. You know you're going to have an extra human being. So it is just hitting them, but you can't hit them out into areas away from your help. It's kind of like knowing where your buddy is. So it's easy to say, hey, like you can call a coverage like cover two and say, hey, we're going to beat them up. It's one thing to beat and be physical, but you're going to miss occasionally. They're awesome across from you. It's, do you chuck them to the right place when you miss? Do you funnel them to the areas you want them to be as you're being physical with them? Do you send them away from where your vulnerabilities are in your particular defense? So that's kind of the way it's thought of. It's, yes, we got to be physical, but it's overemphasizing that part. I mean, a great example is a year ago, you look at the Colts game against the Chiefs. The Colts, pathetic performance, I believe it was the first half, most of the first half into the third, where you watch, and that was the tape I was watching preparing for the Chiefs game, for the Patriots to face him, and you just watch Tyreek and Kelsey build 7, 8, 9 yards into the route atop the stem before they've even been touched. And it was kind of back to that same thing. It's not which coverage you choose. If you let someone build on you and then get to make the choice at the top of the route, shoot, they're going to be they're too good. You can't allow that to happen. So you can say, hey, let's all be physical. Oh, no one else had thought of that. No, it's not so it's that. It's just that when you're being physical, are you sent into a smart place? Do you work well with one another when you're beating them up? Do you transition out of that into picking up the right guys once it becomes a little more recess? So there's some art behind this, or there's some science behind the art, but you do have to kind of, you know, be able to pull both levers. But I love that part of it, because you kind of know there's a lot of stuff going on, but he is really good at pulling out the elemental part.
Would it be fair to say that you're trying to induce them into doing something they're not comfortable doing?
Right, yeah, because you're used to seeing him roar off. He's used to letting, you know, like Ike or well, here's a great example.
Make them play left-handed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a great way to put it. Backhanders and hockey all day long. Just don't let him ever get to his forehand side. And or any other way of looking at it, saying, you know what, this is a guy that's been tearing through the NFL, but shoot, if he's always getting that jumper from 12 feet, well, why don't we make him shoot it from 14 today? Or fuck it, let's make him go left-handed and play off the dribble. Let's find out what he does best. He's not doing that today. Let's test him on the things that he isn't typically forced into doing. So the point of that is it's more about elements. It's more about themes than it's ever about a particular call, a particular coverage, a particular toggle of this, that, or the other. So it does. It kind of makes me roll my eyes when they come in and say, I've got the magic plan, and you read that column, you see that segment, you spend all the hours that I know people are spending trying to break it down that way, but it's actually at the professional level not really what they're spending their time on. Now that's not to say that the position coaches aren't going, he comes in with the themes, they put the ones together that fit the theme, but then every call's got half a dozen tags that go with it that, you know, make them non-basic like you'd see in a training camp kind of situation. But that's what makes it fun. I mean, it's a really, really deep kind of chess-like game, and that's why I like it.
You know, so color me cynical. I don't really think the mediates have much of a clue what they're looking at.
Well, I wouldn't expect them to, and I think that's part of it. Like, some of the guys that I love, and you know, it's easy to be fans of guys that I work with, but I get lucky, and I do. I pick where I work, and I've kind of gotten to that sort of comfortable situation here in this market. I love Jeff Howe. You know, Jeff is really good. He's an incredible reporter. He's got great sources, but he's very responsible with what he writes. He's responsible with the position he takes. He does do a lot of legwork as far as tracking things. It helps him sort of hone in on it, but he also knows where the line is. At no point is he going to tell you, it was this coverage if they only ran this coverage, or he's not going to say, hey, this is the guy that screwed up. That motherfucker needs to stop screwing up. Like, one of the biggest things you learn in the NFL, especially haven't sat through meetings where sometimes you are the mistake. Well, here, I'll give you a quick example. This is the one I always use from when I was with the Jets, and we were playing on Thanksgiving against Cowboys in the old stadium, we had a coverage that, again, there's no NFL Game Pass at that time, no subscription service, but I guarantee you, whatever, and this isn't attacking any particular human being, but it could be anyone in this market, it could be anyone nationally that's doing this and wants to be tape breakdown guy and write a column about it, do a segment about it, do a video, whatever. You could not have taken my play and gotten it right. And here's what it was. We had a tagged coverage that was also a split call. So we had one coverage we'll be playing in 2x2. Another coverage we'll be playing if it's 3x1. And those numbers mean the eligible. So two to one side, two to the other, or three to one side and one. So we're going to change the call if someone motions and we're tagging it with some other little thing if he ends up motioning to a certain area or whatever. So we do top-down calls when I was there, a lot like the Patriots do. You know, Lawyer was a stud. Rodney's a stud. Those guys really run the show. Linebackers kind of run the core, a guy like Bruschi. But when you have those split calls, you got to make sure the underneath coverage is running the same coverage as the guys behind you. And I ran the tagged call. I ran what I was supposed to run, which was a cover four kind of thing. And in those situations, I'm covering Jason Witten. I'm only told to carry him to a certain depth. You know, you carry him to 12 feet up to the seam, and then you're turning him over to a safety. And went on motion, that's the call we ran with. But the back end was running a different call than we were running underneath. You know, Vilma and Barton and myself, and I think it was probably Victor Hobson at the time. We were all running the first half of the call, and the back end was running the other half of the call. And, if you watch the TV copy, I think it was Phil Simms, if I remember correctly, at the time. But, you know, the commentary goes, oh, why is Chatham covering, you know, Jason Witten? Because it looks like I carry him to a certain distance, and I stop running. I take him to the 12 I'm supposed to, and I'm supposed to be turning him over to a safeties over the top of me. Well, the safeties were playing a different call than we were. It was just a miscommunication by front and back. But if you watched it, if you tried to grade it now, if you were one of these grading services or somebody breaking out film, you would have just thought I blew the coverage, or you just thought I got beat by Jason Witten. And I mean, right. He's a Hall of Famer. He's a stud. I'm not saying that I'm going to be able to cover him most times, but I gave it up because of a call difference, something you could not possibly know. I can watch it now, and if I didn't know that, I wouldn't know what was going on. So that's just the nature of the NFL, and that's why sometimes you'll hear old position coaches or coordinators will kind of give a salty answer about how the fuck could you possibly know what we're running to grade me, you know? And that's why, that's how it works.
Well, I'll tell you what, I grade that answer a plus 2.7.
Let me ask you this. That, what's the proper amount of force to tackle a mostly naked person in the Super Bowl?
You do not want to land on them. I was careful of that. You know, it's the significant amount of force to get them down hard, but you didn't want to do the form tackle, lay on them thing. I got to do a fun piece. It was right when I started into the writing. I think it was actually after that season. No, that's not correct. I think it was 2005 off season, but I was the answer fella for Esquire magazine. I lived down there in the summer for, I'd write midweek on Wednesdays and Thursdays, drive down to the Hearst Corporation building, and that was sort of my first taste. It was like a summer internship for the NFL, and one of the first pieces they let me write was we were doing a What It Feels Like segment. So I had to interview people all summer long about what it feels like, and it was like crazy stuff like, gosh, I don't even remember what it feels like to jump out of an airplane and just stuff that was like sort of all over the board. And then they're like, hey, you should write a what it feels like to tackle the naked guy. And I'm like, well, fuck. That's a great piece to write. I think the biggest thing that came out of it was sort of the jokes that sort of transcend time here with my buddies, the other guys on the field. Izzo sitting next to me at center. I'm at guard. Bruce behind me at the fullback spot. And there's the moment where we're all kind of looking around at each other going, are you going to do something? Are you going to do that? Like, what the hell's going on here? And then when you finally hit them, it's the thing that I'll wrestle around or screw around, or maybe after drinks you kind of start having play fights or whatever with buddies or things like that now. And one of the things that Mike, I know you're a huge guy too, but this people don't realize, really big people, how much bigger they are than them. You know, and it's something that until you get down on an NFL field, and you know, I'm just 250 pound guy that, you know, can run pretty well, and that's kind of why I did special teams, but I barely hit the guy and he flew, you know. And it's situations like that with friends that'll come home and you'll have a few drinks in the backyard, barbecue and whatever. And you just, the strength of an NFL player, not me necessarily, but just any of these guys, the cornerbacks, you know, bench press 25 reps. Yeah. These guys are ludicrous. Like, just everyone is strong. The kickers are strong guys. But it's just forgetting about that. You get far away from it. I start to think of myself as a big guy, and I'm very medium in the NFL parlance. You go down and I see other buddies like, well, Joe, I see Andrewsy all the time, but, you know, running to Jarvis Green the other day and Patrick Pass, and you remember, holy shit, these guys are all huge. They're monsters. You get back in that room and realize how big these people are. So
Streaker
runs on the field and he's not going to.
You mispronounce good looking, Matt.
What's that? I mispronounced
handsome. Yeah.
There you go.
Can you?
So well, I want to hit you with five rapid fire questions, Matt.
Let's do it.
I'm a huge fan of David Faraday. I'm shamelessly stealing his segment. You might say I'm Borgesing his segment. So I'm gonna hit you with five here. Okay. Foxborough or Gillette Stadium?
I'll go Gillette, 1,000%. I'm a trivia question, guys. Got to go with that. I'm the first tackle in the history of the building.
Last tackle in Super Bowl 38.
There you go. First one that and two.
Best team you played on?
Oh, wow. They're all my children. They got to be equal. I'll stay there all the same. But, man, that defense on the middle one was pretty damn good.
The 04 team brought back most of those and added Corey Dillon. You know, listen, you're the expert in this.
Pretty tough crew.
Toughest teammate,
it would probably be Willie on our side of the ball, Steve Neal on the other.
Toughest opponent.
Man, Steelers games were fun. Dan Kreider. I mean, fullbacks with necks that were like 18 inches across. and blocking tight ends and 6'8" tackles and physical games, man. I love playing against Steelers. I can't pass rush worth a lick. So if it's a passing game like Colts games, I don't even get to play. So I look forward to the running game teams. Oh, Pittsburgh, great.
Toughest place to play?
I would probably say it's Denver, just because it's not so much the elevation thing, but it's that place shakes and it's loud and it's just different and they have a great crowd.
It's even tough when you're just covering the game.
There you go.
I mean that might make me sound like a major wuss, but
it's the truth.
Thoughts and prayers, David. Thoughts and prayers.
I went and I saw the Giants play there a couple of years ago, and just as a fan, and that's fine. But working there, yeah, on a cold night, man.
I caved, guys. When I did it for selfish reasons as well. I love to ski. I was a big time skier. And I bought a place in Summit County, which is out in Keystone. So just, go west 110 miles or whatever outside of Denver. And, Denver is the whole 5280 thing. It's the Mile High and all that. Yep. But you go another hour west and you go up a few thousand feet. You work out at 10, And I was doing that for the last couple summers that I was in New England and then the jet years too. And training and the real elevation, that's serious. You get out there and – Keystone and Breck and run and holy hell.
Then so it makes 5,000 John. So you're not saying that John Dem is full of shit then?
He is not full of shit. You knew what he was talking about.
Last one, Matt, in rapid fire, and there's no prizes or anything of that nature, but
damn it.
Many years from now, well, big if true, many years from now when your life flashes before your eyes, what's going to be the most memorable moment of your NFL career?
Most memorable moments probably the tackle in that game in 30 and whatever that was. Is that 38? Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest,
that's the most arrogant thing. Well, which one was it? Yeah. One of the many I played in.
Yeah. One of the many. Exactly. Well, it's because when you have a hand in it, I think you feel more of it. That was scary. It was terrifying. I think it's something that gets brushed by a lot with that whole thing because, Adam makes the big kick. We kind of forget about the kick off that we had to do after. But Steve Smith, who at the time was the best punt returner in the NFL, he was a terror. I believe it was that season or the season prior where he brought one back against us. And we actually got to a point where I believe
he was their Troy. He was their Troy.
He was terrifying, and he was really good at it. I know he becomes a Pro Bowl kind of wide receiver, but he was he was tough in space. And I usually felt pretty comfortable getting most people down. I'd get out in front, throw my guy off on punt, get out in space and see him. And it was like, I couldn't match foot speed with him, obviously. So you're just like lucky to get him down kind of feel with Steve Smith. But the point of that is at the end of that kickoff, Steve Smith is not a kick returner. He's their punt returner. And then, him and Moose Muhammad were the two big time receivers and Ricky Prohl was there as well, but they put him back there. So if you look back in that final kick, Rod Smart, he hate me, who fortunately has been found. I don't know if you guys saw that story, but he's okay now. But they put Steve back there as well. So Rod had led the NFL in kick returns. So they had a really good kick return unit. And then they throw the guy next to him that's probably the all-pro punter from the punt returner for the year.
And Bill did that in Super Bowl 36 after Prohl scored the tying touchdown. He put Troy back to return that kick, and it didn't go well.
Ah, yeah. That's something I wrote about this year where it's kind of been a thing with us. We kicked ass in divisional games and AFC championship games. There's a ton of special teams, big time contributions from the return game I'm talking, throughout the years, but there really had never been a big kick return. Like we have not had super big kick
That's
return
probably
Super
why you
Bowl
guys
production.
Drafted Bethel.
he was a monster. I know a lot of people derogatorily sort of deride him a little bit or whatever, that he's this bust or whatever, because he's a second rounder. Those couple years, man, we were bringing back kicks. We could hit from any point. I mean,
he's almost like the Malcolm Mitchell. I know Malcolm
didn't
return kicks, but like Malcolm had the same kind of impact in 16.
He was scary, and he was on a team where he didn't, you know, I think it's part because he's a second rounder, therefore we expect him to play 8 years, do two contracts, make millions, catch 60, 70, 80 balls every year.
Lazy media narratives. Yeah. You know, you guys don't win that Colts game without Bethel Johnson.
Bethel Johnson, there's a Browns game in there where he had a couple monster ones, a San Diego game, I remember.
Seattle, he had a long touchdown or long reception against Seattle in the 21-game winning streak.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you go back to that long, the long stretch, the 21, 22 thing or whatever, when we were in the midst of that, there's
Matt, you know it's 21. Come on.
Is it 22? It's the long. I actually don't.
21.
Is it 21 and we lost to Pittsburgh to make it 22? Is that what it was? Okay.
On Halloween, you lost in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep well. Thanks a lot. No, but no, if you go back and look at that run and you look at the types of games we ended up in, you know, we were playing great defense, but we weren't scoring 30. We were scoring 24, you know, 22. We were putting
Tom,
it on people sometimes.
Tom wasn't Tom yet. And you guys, you know, Antoine's lost in time. Antoine was such
a beast.
Short trotter back.
Beast. Tough.
And you guys just out-toughed and out-physical and were smarter than everybody. It was just, that 03-04 run.
Dear God,
put that up against any Steeler, Niner, you know, it just, or Jets.
Ted
Washington. The 607 Jets are right there too, right, Matt?
Oh, yeah. What is it, OOTA, or one of the greats? Or I know he's OOTG.
let me jump in here because I want to talk to you about after 2005.
Yes.
How do you wind up in New York? And when I say that, I mean, what was the thought process and what was free agency like for you in that offseason?
Yeah, so, I mean, my NFL career is 3 3-year contracts, right? So you come in as an undrafted free agent, you get a 3-year contract from the Rams. But when I'm released, I'm on waivers, so the Patriots just absorb your deal. So you have no say. They just take it, right? So my restricted free agent year, the Patriots tendered me, so that was it. And then I signed one when I became – I did one deal with them beyond just that rookie deal. So that's my six years. And that was my first chance to kind of be a full go out there. And I can talk about this pretty openly now. I see the wisdom and the way they do things. I also have no misgivings about what I was as a player. I was a very good run defender, a dog shit pass rusher, and a good special teams player. So I'm going to be a role player the rest of my life. Probably not a starter on most people's teams because you kind of need both those skills to stay on the field for full sets of plays. That's who I am. When I watch film of myself, that's what I see. And they knew that probably better than I did, you know. And when I had an opportunity for agency to, you know, potentially be a starter at some other places, and New England didn't like me in that role. They loved me in my role. Hey, we're a 3-4 team. You're the fifth guy in. You know, you can play Mike if you have to. You can rotate in on the outside. You're never going to pass rush, but you can cover a little bit. We love you on special teams. You'd be a veteran for us there. But when you hit free agency, you get that first taste and you hear somebody else telling you something different, you know, it's tempting. It's kind of one of those things where you're a competitor your whole life and you don't want to die without having found out for sure that you couldn't have, you know, that kind of thing. So I took it, and I don't regret it. It's not that. It's just that, you know, I also had an issue throughout my career. I played, but I was banged up a lot. I mean, I was Humpty Dumpty, surgery every offseason guy.
And you knew Mangini, right? That was probably a big part of it.
Well, that's a big part of it. So, you know, he's advocating heavily. He always thought, you know, at least the way he represented to me, that he thought I could have a much bigger role there. But I went down there and I tore my sesamoid joint in minicamp. So in the offseason practices, I'm covering Thomas Jones. I blow out my, you know, just covering him one on and one out in space, and take a cut on that shitty Hofstra turf. And I ripped the big toe joint, just shredded it like a person would do an ACL, but I did it to my foot. Now I played the whole season that damn thing. I was a captain. You feel kind of obligated. I've been brought in here to do this. I'm going to tape it up and I'm going to play through this thing and then have this sort of ACL surgery after the year. But I was a mess. So that was kind of my big moment. And I think in conversations with Scott and Bill and Peely on the way out the door, I mean, they felt comfortable with me and my role and weren't willing to pay over that. And they did have concerns about, even if we did have you started, could you play 16, you know, with 60 reps every game? And of course I can. And, you know, I go down there and rip something out in the very first minicamp. Now, I played all 16 games that season, but I was taped together. So they were right. They were right about me.
So they did want you back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they make an offer and they have a number. And it's part of sort of the business understanding of it. And they valued me in a role. That role has a sort of a number to it. One of the things that happens in free agency, at least did, you know, 10 years ago when I came out, is you get a spreadsheet. And they, you know, for me, it's they point to all the top special teams bigs, you know, and special teams guys are not all the same. You know, we had Gerard Cherry, and, you know, you got sort of your Patrick Passes, the running back body that would be more like a Bolden now. Gerard Cherry is more like a gunner that's similar to, say, like a Matthew Slater. Is more like the Pat, you know, he's a linebacker technically, but he's more like, you know, like the Chung role, or maybe even Nate Ebner as a fullback on the punt team, and then like a guy that's all over the place on kickoff. But I'm the big, right? I'm the heavier guy. I'm the enforcer, whatever you want to call it. But, like, I'm going to have to hit the wedges. I may be in the wedges. I'm the big blocker guy on all the punt returns. I take their best. So it's a role. And they give you a spreadsheet, and they find those kind of guys on all the other teams and say, here's this guy from Denver. Here's this guy from Seattle. Here's this guy from blah, 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 blah. Here's what they make. We value that way. You're that kind of player. We value more than those guys. We're not going to pay you more. So it's kind of they slot you. You know, they kind of say, here are the comps, and here's what you're being paid. And you're trying to make the argument at the time that, no, I'm a Sam linebacker. So
I'm something else, right?
Yeah, go look at what all the other Sams value. Make. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but you don't have the history of that. You have a history as a guy who plays maybe 10, maybe 20 defensive plays a week. It just, and you know, just depends. And then I'm a special teams guy. So they're paying you at the special teams rate, even though you think you're coming in a role you're going to play more the linebacker. Then you get hurt, so you're kind of back into that part-time linebacker, full-time special teams guy.
Well, let me ask you, let me pivot on that, Matt. So you just referenced, you're a defensive player, but, you know, if we're being honest, you're remembered as a really, really good special teams player. The NFL, under the guise of, you know, concussion protocol and other things, has really taken a war upon special teams. You know, how do you feel about the rules changes going on? And how does it affect special teams play? And more importantly, special teams has the most impact on field position in terms of yards per play. So how do you feel about that?
Yeah, so it's obviously something that if I advocate too heavily for it, it's almost as if, wow, there's just such a bias for it, and it's how you made your career, so you're going to overemphasize how important it is, or you're going to advocate that it stay because that's what kept you in the league or something like that. And to me, it's more of a purist argument. It's more about, no, this is how this game is. If we wanted to get into a situation where we weren't having competitions over the change of possession, we could just do tennis, you know? You could do your side, I do mine, and we just walk past each other and switch sides, you know?
But that's what they want.
I know, like, and it's ludicrous. To me, it's the people that don't inherently understand the game. That's why I like Bill so much. He's such a historian of the game. He really kind of gets at his essence why we do what we do. It's a strategy game. It's a three option, four if you want to go there. Contested open field change of possession with a lot of field position at play. Special teams know is not a third of the game technically by play count, but when you start looking at breadth of yardage, because you know, one punt play is more important than a first down run play. It just
nothing affects field position more.
Yeah. So I think it cuts to the essence of what the game is supposed to be all about. There are supposed to be these other plays between them. Now, one of the really interesting conversations I had, and I get it why this is. And you know, again, when I do my games for ESPN and we're calling, ACC games or the AAC, the American stuff, and, you know, we're on ESPN3 or ACC Network or, you know, a more of a, skeleton is the wrong word, but it's a different kind of crew than when I'm doing the preseason games for the Patriots. You know, you don't have 15 cameras kind of thing. And one of the things that you learn from sort of the production value of football games is there's a reason I think fans have some of the perception they do about special teams. You feel like it's unimportant because it's not shown to you. And I know where that comes from. And I've gotten to have conversations where I do these NFL broadcast boot camps. I did those back-to-back years down at NFL Media in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. And you get to know the guys that put on the Super Bowls, the guys who do it for Fox, the guys that do it for CBS, the guys that have been sort of making the decisions for why you guys at home get to see what you see when you see a football game. And the hard decisions have been made over time that they don't really know how to show special teams. It's complicated. They have ad things they need to show. They love to show graphics between plays. They'd much rather use the transition to do other elements, to show other things, to bring in the talk component. And quite frankly, there's a high percentage of quarterbacks in that color role and that color, and he can't tell you what the fuck he's looking at on a punt return anyway. So you don't have a very skilled person to talk about it. And you don't basically have two people that can't explain what they're seeing. And you have.
So basically, they're media.
Yeah, yeah, and you have an incentive on the other side not to use it for that. You know, it can be a transition into an ad. It can be a transition into an additional ad space. You know, you can bring up some sort of graphic that's push-sponsored by something that they want to use there.
Oh, as Matt opposed to Matt Chadmus made the tackle to win the Super Bowl. Let's go on. let's go on for like me undies.
Exactly. Right. But I mean, that's I gripe about this. You guys watch me on Twitter, even from where I'm up in the booth or not the booth, but up in the media area or at games. And or you'll see, or even when I'm home, because I don't travel, because we do studio stuff here at NESN on a road game. So I never go on the road with the Patriots games. So we'll be up there and it'll be like, there'll be some crazy bad punt, or, you know, there'll be some broken play in special teams, or maybe one breaks for 30. And I'm like, okay, great. Now show it. Let's see what the fuck happened. And then it's like, oh, now we're looking at a graphic. And do you know that quarterback Bill is from Puxatani? And I'm like, no, what the fuck are we talking about? Like, go show that play. And it has come to that point, though. So can you imagine if you're at home and you're being sort of spoon-fed what they're telling you is the important things, the things you should care about? The game hasn't changed that much. I mean, they've tried to rule change a little bit. Yes, less kickoffs come out, but the punt return stuff is unchanged. The kick of stuff when they happen, I like that the rule change didn't change that much. They eliminated wedge. That's good. But if you never get to see it, I think as a consumer, you would have the impression that it's having less of an effect because they're not talking about it. But if they could figure out a way to do it, and I pressure them, I always bust balls, but, you know, I'm not in a high enough position to force that. But when they do, it'll be better.
This begs the question, would you consider yourself a special teams honk, a special teams bobo, or a special teams green teamer?
I'm not going to bite on that. Those people died in my brain years ago.
90 seconds, no commercials. Chatham tackles a naked guy.
There you go. Let's put it this way. I like to prophesize. Is that what it is? I like to highlight things that I know aren't being shown, that I know.
Dave, this is a family show. Could you edit this out, please?
There you go. Yeah.
Well, all right. So how about let's wrap this up. And Matt, I'm just going to throw one last thing to you, which is you played for the 2002 Patriots and the 2005 Patriots. So would you like to apologize on behalf of yourself or the entire teams?
2 and 5. Oh, yeah, exactly. For letting the world down, yeah.
I'm sorry, Dave. He has so many rings. He can't differentiate
the seasons. You know, I'm not one to make a CTE joke, but I'm wondering if that's what it is right now. You're stressing me with all these callbacks. So, no, I mean, it is funny, though, when you I think one of the cool things about getting to play in the NFL and sort of having that blessing and experience to do stuff that kids just dream about that you didn't really think you'd get to do, but you got to do it for a long time. You get to meet guys on other teams, and I think that really helps you appreciate it more. You know, I have friends that played for the Vikings for most of their career, or the Packers, or the Cowboys, or Redskins guys, or guys that played at the Bills.
You have to be the object of envy for those guys.
Yeah, but you also come to appreciate how rare your experience was, and it's not just rare to like Patriots fans and people get to talk about here, but it's other guys that had long careers and made money themselves, but they ended every year mad, you know, and it's that's the norm, but that's the norm. So I think it helps you really appreciate it for what it was. And yeah, I mean, they are beating their heads. And I know there's just sort of a general sense of frustration throughout the league, especially in people that cover it. When is this shit going to end? Because we want to talk about somebody else, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I think there's gonna be a lot of angry people out there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the time, Matt. We really appreciate it. I could tell you, I have no trouble speaking on behalf of Ironhead. We both love your work, and we think you're doing great stuff, so keep it up. And hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up with you later, maybe during the season.
All right, Mike and Dave, thank you, and good luck with the pod.
I love you vouching for Howe and Reese, because they're great. The Patriots Media Corps has the highest ceiling in the deepest basement.
All of our guests, so far, all of our guests have gone off and praised Jeff Howe to no end. So let's see if we can get them to do that every week. That's it.
Here's my quick spiel on media is there are so many more people to appreciate in my market, and we all know the dipshits. They're just, they don't deserve the air, and it's not even to go after them. It's just, I can tell you there are,
Matt,
you know, six or seven super.
That's my mission statement, Matt.
That's your mission statement. So I'm trampling. So yeah. So the point of it is,
the fact that a three-time Super Bowl champion can trampoline off of my idiocy, I love it.
I think, you know what part of it is too? I got a family, I got young kids, wife I love dearly, a lot of other stuff going on in private life, and you just say, you know what, I even get into the ones that suck. Let's concentrate on the great ones we got, because there are a lot of good ones and
leave
a lot
that
of good
to me.
Buddies.
Leave that to me.
Exactly, that's my point. There are people that are exceptional at that part, that's you guys, and keep knocking it out of the park.
All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot, and we'll look forward to talk to you later.
He is three-time Super Bowl champion and former Jet Matt Chatham. Thank you for coming on Entitled Town. Good luck and God bless in your media endeavors.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye. All right. Well, there you have it. That was Matt Chatham. Thank you very much, Matt, for coming on. And this is the point in the show when we have completed the interview, and now we're full of regrets because the person is off the phone. So let me ask you, Ironhead.
Well, I'm just glad that I didn't go Chris Farley with Paul McCartney on it.
That was a big win. That was a big win for us.
Allegedly.
Let me ask you, what are your regrets from the Matt Chatham interview?
I hate media. And I would love to have asked him in retrospect. I have a legal pad worth of questions that I wish I had gotten to ask him, but he expounded so wonderfully on our fucking stupid questions. Wish I had asked them, you know, which asshole came up to your locker who said, hey, can I have a few minutes of your time? Would most make you want to get four Excedrin and pop them before talking to them because you knew it was going to be a tedious, you know, just, you know, something that made your brain hurt.
So you want to ask him who he had the worst experiences with?
Who is the biggest fucking moron in Boston media? I would like to think hyperlocally he would answer truthfully, but, you know, he's too much of a gentleman to ever, you know, kind of throw. He's in media now, so he's not going to throw Molotov cocktails at the dummies that surround him because he stands out because, you know, he has.
Well, I'm sure that there were people who he might have found tough to deal with back then, and maybe they're not even you know, working anymore, but on some level, that's,
or maybe
that's,
he had some
curious
insight on where Brady's money was being funneled to. We should have asked him that.
Well, I'll tell you, on the first question, it might have been interesting because it probably would have given us some insight into things that reporters do that players don't like. But and it probably would have led to some. Matt's always good with. He's got a great memory, good experience conveying his. Thoughts through past experiences. I think it would have been a good question.
I think the answer to what do mediates do that players don't like, the answer is easy. Exist.
Okay. Well, for those
of you. I just made me remember uncomfortable. There we go.
I think Iron Mike Irons just questioned your right to exist, which I promise you is not a threat. Okay. Finally, my regrets. Can I do my regrets?
Your regret is actually agreeing to do this with me.
I mean, you're not right, but you're not wrong. Now, here's my regrets are.
That's the last 15 years of my life. Thank you, David.
I just wanted to ask him about two food-related questions. He attempted to patent the crepe fry when he was the proprietor of a crepe business known as Sky Crepers.
I'm not going there.
Matt Brandt, and me, as an attorney who's worked with a number of businesses, I could sit and talk to him for an hour just about Sky Crepers. And I also wanted to talk to him about Parenti's, which is the bar across the street from Bryant College, where a lot of the players used to go and hang out. And that's where I used to go.
Hold on. Parentes? The bar is called Parentes?
The bar is called Parentes.
And is that where Yankee fans go to flagellate themselves? I mean, Jesus.
You know what? Christ. Honestly, I did once. You're referring to Mike Parente.
The great Mike Parente. He was my biggest, you know, guilty pleasure follow on Twitter.
Well, I've known Mike for 20 years.
After the Yankees sweep the Red Sox, he basically has a noose fashioned, and you're one of his best friends. That says a lot about you, David.
Well, I did once have a long talk with Parente at Parente's, but I assure you that was purely coincidence. My friends and I used to go there back in college because that was cheap wings and cheap beer. So you get pitchers and you load up on buffalo wings, and it was a great spot, and a lot of the Patriots players used to go there. And
foreshadowing, it was cheap, so it was foreshadowing your career as a journalist. There we go.
That's true. And apparently they once some guys once took Kevin Falk there when he was a rookie and got him drunk, and he couldn't get out of bed for practice the next morning. they were all drinking water, and they said, as a rookie, you have to keep up with us.
There's a great story.
And he didn't know they were drinking water. So he was trying to keep up with them, and then they all went to Belichick the next day and said, this is our fault. So that brings us to really the moment of judgment here in Entitled Town for our first guest, Matt Chatham, Ironhead.
David.
Do you vouch or no vouch?
Oh, absolute vouch. You know, like I'm glad I didn't go full fanboy Chris Farley style and not vouch. Hashtag vouch. 100%. No takes backs.
All right. I'm in agreement. Full vouch for me.
I vouch for you, but I do vouch for Chatham.
Full. Likewise. I'm reserving my vouch with you, but no terms and conditions. And my
You're showing blood some decision-making skills and having me, you know, on with you. But you
well,
know,
that's what I'm here for. It's the decision-making. Okay, so we vouch for Matt Chatham, and then next week we come back when the big question will be: do we vouch for William Bendetsa, our guest?
William.
Our guest next week on Entitled Town.
David, thank you. We'll see you next week.